This week on Big Sisters in STEM, I'm joined by two guests, Alice and Ishita. Alice is an academic at the University of Manchester, a professor in climate science and policy at the Tyndall Centre, and she was the head of engineering at Manchester. And Ishita is currently a first-year materials science student, and she is also very passionate about sustainability. So, that's this week. Something that I thought would be a nice way to start today was talking about that feeling of with sustainability, but also with being a woman in STEM, that feeling of being at what you've described, Alice, as the crest of a wave, and what that really means and how that feels. Is that something which you're very aware of all the time?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it was something that became apparent when I was like choosing to do the particular A-levels I was going to do and then thinking about what degree I wanted to do. And there was quite a lot of encouragement for girls, you know, at school to be thinking about whether or not they wanted to do sort of STEM subjects. So there was this kind of sense of there's a minority group out there and, you know, you could be part of making that, you know, less of a minority. Mm. And so there's quite a lot of support, a lot of encouragement. And so you sort of felt like at every stage, whether it was like when I was learning and studying or whether it was then when there were opportunities to kind of go into different types of work, there was often encouragement and support and special events and special activities that go on to say, you know, this can be for you and you should be encouraged to do this. And this is an important thing for you to do. So in a way, you're kind of feeling at this kind of crest of the wave.
So you were really aware of that because people around you were saying this is something that needs to change.
Yeah, definitely.
Quite early.
And particularly because I was very interested in sort of physics and astronomy. Mm. I was a bit of a stargazer as a kid, you know, like sort of balancing my telescope on the windowsill and hoping my mum and dad wouldn't hear that I was like still up at 3 a.m. looking out for various things. Started to do my degree in physics. And I did go and visit, you know, various universities and things trying to work out where I wanted to be. Mm. And one of the things that was quite apparent was sometimes I would turn up and I might be the only, you know, woman who was like applying, or I didn't meet any members of staff who weren't men. And, you know, like, so it just became a kind of a thing that I wanted to not, you know, it's okay to be in a minority. I just didn't want to be the only one. So you kind of felt like, I can see why there's a need for that encouragement and support, because you could get very easily put off. And that's quite visible, you know, quite a long time ago this was, of course. It's been there all the way along, I think, for me.
Mm. Is that something that you've felt as well, Ishita?
Yeah, so for me, I'm from Mumbai and I come from almost like a family of engineers. My mom is an engineer, my dad is an engineer. So I think it was a very natural decision for me because I was always surrounded by people in STEM. But having said that, as a child, I was like selected by the school to represent, like make electricity from salt water and doing all these like little experiments and stuff. So I always liked the practical side of science, especially like where you could see what you're doing. So I was always, I wouldn't say I was quite confused between like the sciences and the arts, because I'm very inclined towards that as well. But then I thought I could make a bigger change by, especially with sustainability. And then when I found out about materials, I found it really interesting because it's very interdisciplinary.
When did you find out about materials? How early on was that on your
This was honestly
discovery.
Very recent. It was in my last year of school. So I always I was pretty sure I wanted to do engineering, but I wasn't sure which branch of it, because there's so many.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to restrict myself towards like something I didn't want to do and that I couldn't change later. But then I think in my last year, when I was still applying to college, I found out about materials. There was this book called Stuff Matters by Mark Mirdanik. And I read that and I really liked it. And so that's when I decided to do it. And since I've come here, I've noticed that there's like way fewer girls on my course than boys. But the girls that are there, we have a very strong bond and sense of friendship, and then we help each other. So it's a nice environment. Yeah.
That's so interesting that for both of you, you've talked about the people around you kind of on this journey. So for Alice, at school, people saying it's really important that girls are getting into STEM. And then when we're actually in those environments, having that kind of group that supports one another is important too, kind of in the way you were saying, Ishtar, about on your course, all the girls have this kind of common thread. Do you think finding that sense of community is easy or something that you sought out on purpose, or did it just kind of come naturally?
I mean, in my experience, it sort of comes quite naturally. There's a kind of, I don't think you even need to articulate it necessarily to each other to say, you know, have you been feeling a bit awkward about X or Y as well? Or, you know, has this thing been an issue for you? You kind of, you know, it's just, you're not thinking about it consciously as such, but you are connecting with people who maybe are not feeling as kind of, as kind of bound up by the majority, I guess, as some people. And it's not, you know, exclusively, you know, of course, women and girls that are kind of feeling this. So, you know, there's lots of people who feel like they're in a minority group one way or another. And so I just think that you seem to kind of connect with people in those groups where you just feel like the mainstream stuff that you're maybe being either taught or talked about, or the systems and processes around you are kind of, you're slightly on the edge of them. One way or another, you feel like you're slightly kind of like, not quite, you know, in what was being thought about when X, Y, or Z was being kind of designed, if you like. So, yeah, you kind of connect a bit naturally, I think, with other people who are sort of struggling with similar things.
No, I agree with that as well. I haven't, even if by number women are a minority, especially like, for example, on my course, I've never really felt that I was disadvantaged in any way so far, at least. And then, yeah, the bonding, it comes naturally, really. You just kind of happen to stick together. And having said that, even though the girls in my course have a strong bond, strong friendships, and we help each other, it's not like we've been felt like they're made less by the boys. So everyone's been like equally nice. So even though you are part of the minority technically, I've never really felt like a strong, glaring disadvantage or in any way so far.
That's really nice. I think there is an unspoken sense of like the unspoken things which you kind of pick up on, and you get when somebody sees your perspective. It does come quite naturally. And that's something that I think I had when I went to uni. I was nervous about meeting people who were, everyone tells you uni is a great place to meet like-minded people. But it does come quite naturally. It doesn't feel like something, I guess if you never went to your lectures or seminars, maybe you wouldn't meet that many people, but it does feel like something that comes quite naturally and that you shouldn't be nervous of. You will kind of find that support. Do you have any academics from your experience now, Ishita, or when you were at uni, Alice, or even now in your role, that you've found you've been able to talk to them as well about your experiences and kind of potential guidance?
Do you mean in terms of like other people who might see that there are various maybe barriers that are kind of in the way and how to kind of overcome them?
Yeah, when I went to university, my personal tutor, she was a woman, and she kind of took me under her wing after, in the first seminar I went along to, I had a bit of an argument with another student, and she afterwards said he was just being a bit belittling. And straight off the bat, I knew that she just understood what that felt like. And it was really, really validating to have her kind of say that, you know, you weren't saying something silly, you know, that was just, I don't know, just something that you're going to have to get used to, but it's not necessarily something that we can't change.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think for me, I probably didn't have that experience during my undergraduate degree as such, but it was certainly when I started doing my PhD, it was relatively unusual that I was in a physics department and I had a female supervisor, which was, a woman supervisor. It was quite unusual. And although, I mean, quite a number of things actually I hadn't clocked could be barriers at that point. So you kind of like, you know, starting to think about a career, or I was starting to think about a career in academia. And I could see, you know, she in her own life had young children. She was working part time. But as far as I could make out, she wasn't working part time at all. She was working really long hours. But officially, it was called part time.
Yeah.
In order that she could have that flexibility to kind of, you know, do some caring responsibilities. And I'd never really thought about those aspects becoming more challenging and actually needing just some consideration, some support, some understanding. And so I think that at that point, I could see that actually having people who had different experiences, so it didn't have to be that particular experience, but the idea that there are kind of different, you know, people who have different lives, who have different complications in their own lives, and having other people who can kind of look out for you and point those sorts of things out, that became important at that point. For me, and it became quite visible, having someone who herself was in a role where she was having to kind of challenge some of the barriers or some of the kind of norms that were around, particularly where we were, because it was a science and engineering university. So there were, you know, there were very much in a minority in that particular university, unlike Manchester, where, you know, it's not like that there, like that here. Mm.
Go on.
I would say, I mean, so far in my first semester, I was taught by, I think all my lecturers were male. So I haven't had any female lecturers, nor even my academic advisor is also a man. But I've never really felt belittled, as you said, or that they were unsupportive. So I still feel that if I did have anything, I could always go to them for any advice or any support that I need. But then it also made it when we talked for the first time at the coffee shop, it was really nice to talk to Alice as well, because I think she understood it from a different way that perhaps they might not have. So it's nice to just get this different perspectives on how people think. And of course, she's had a lot more experience than I have in the field. So since I'm relatively new, I can't say much about, you know, like meeting people and feeling a certain way. But I'm sure that as my career goes on, I will be exposed to these things.
It makes me really happy to hear that you feel you can, like, talk to your lecturers who are men. Like, that's amazing to hear, and to feel like you have supportive peers. I think that makes me feel like things are getting better in a way, which everybody wants to be the case. But yeah, I guess there's always that sense of kind of even communication styles of women and men and anyone that's maybe slightly different from the way things have been done before. You can feel like you might have to adapt how you're, like, I know we've spoken before about feeling you're not wanting to impose your opinion on someone, kind of being like, I think or I believe, and then the guy next to you puts up his hand and just says something like it's a fact. And it can take a bit of time to just kind of adjust. And there's kind of different pathways you can take in terms of, do I want to conform to that way? Or do I want to stay as I am? Mm-hmm. Which can be a bit of a journey in itself, I feel. Something that was a natural thing that I really wanted to talk to both of you about was that crest of a wave thing comes with being the first to maybe raise issues in sustainability, climate change. They're both that area and intersection. There's so much new burgeoning information all the time, and also perspectives that feed into that conversation. How easy is that, kind of constantly speaking out about quite big things? And do you find that something that in being a woman you can tap into, how it feels to speak up about things from a different perspective?
I mean, I think there are definitely advantages of the kind of resilience that you might build up when you have been speaking from a position of being in a minority group. That means that when you do come up against sort of other challenging fora, maybe you've kind of built some of that kind of experience and some of that confidence, I suppose. I mean, I used to be terrified. You know, I remember at school, I'd never put my hand up. I'd never want to speak up. And I was really quite timid until, like, quite late on in my sort of university experience, where I'd had to do kind of presentations and stuff and had to speak out about things. I'd been, like, kind of not forced to, but, you know, it was part of the course, so I didn't have any choice.
Yeah.
And you know, the world didn't end when it happened, and you didn't, you know, I didn't get swallowed up by the you know, the ground or anything. But it was just, I just used to feel really terrified. And then I think as you kind of gradually build that confidence, the bigger the group got, you know, like I would speak up in a smallish group, and then if it got a little bit bigger, I might be intimidated. But then the next time I might be brave enough. Mm. And I think then there's also that sense that when you're working in an area like climate change and sustainability, to a degree you feel some sort of responsibility that you know stuff, you do know stuff. No, just because you might not want to stick your hand straight up and say, this is a fact. You know stuff, and you need to be able to influence the debates. It's important because we, you know, frankly, haven't got a great deal of time to sort out the climate change problem. You know, it does matter.
You don't want to sit on important things.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's a bit scary, you know, when you know that people are then looking at you, when you put your hand up, you're making a point, and you might get challenged and criticised. And I think one of the things that has improved a lot in my own experience over the years is how academic conferences kind of go now, and how you might be received if you're kind of speaking at an academic conference. It used to be much more challenged, much more kind of confrontational, I would say. Mm. And it would definitely be the case that people who perhaps felt that they were in a minority in the room would not speak out, because it was a real kind of quite aggressive culture, I would say. Now, I'm not saying that's gone completely, but it's definitely improved. And it's so important in an area like climate change, because you want to hear from a diverse range of voices. There's no point in hearing from the same voices, because those same voices, you know, largely have been the people who haven't actually managed to solve this crisis. Do you know what I mean? So that diversity is so important, really, really important.
That sense of challenging the way things are done, or a perspective that's put across, don't just accept it. That challenging pushes it forward.
And exactly,
that,
yeah.
When you put forward something that maybe has a slightly different take, it can be scary, because you're not just saying, yes, you're right, yeah, that's great. So it does take a bit of gumption, a bit of bravery, I suppose. Do you find it a natural thing on your course at the moment?
No, just like exactly like you said, I feel like I found myself using a lot of phrases like in my opinion and I think when I'm talking about things, because even if I know that I might be right, or at least I have like some sort of a coherent opinion on something, I don't want to impose it on someone. It's scary to like say something as a concrete fact when, you know, someone could challenge it. But then I do find myself trying to consciously change that now, try to be more confident. I would say in school, like, I remember you said you had a brother as well. So my brother's always known as, like, was always the debater in the family and the public speaker and stuff. And I was the reader and the writer. But I was never really afraid of public speaking or anything. I just didn't do it. I just didn't feel the need to. But then coming to university, I've sort of just, like, pushed myself. So at the scholarship ceremony...
You're a great speaker.
I just try. But at the scholarship ceremony that you saw me at, there was this Google form that we had to fill before it. And they just asked you if you wanted to be a keynote speaker or not. And it was just like a tick, yes or no tick box. And I just happened to tick yes. And then I happened to give the speech. And then you happened to see me. And now I'm here. So I just feel like it makes a difference when you actually put yourself out there. So speaking out is important. For me, like, I could see it happen in my personal life. But with climate change and sustainability, just... And it can mean so much, especially because we need like all these diverse voices and more seats at the table for people from different backgrounds. But I do feel that once you just like push yourself out there, things just start to happen. So that first step is really important.
I agree. And you said, you described that as I just happened to say yes. Yeah. You didn't just happen. You made a choice.
Decision.
It was a good decision. And good things do come of kind of putting yourself out there. And there is overlap between your experiences in kind of pushing things forward at the crest of a wave as women and being in the field that you're in, Alice, and that you are moving towards, Ishtar. Like, it's really interesting to me that there's a few different ways in which we probably need to adapt what those fields and areas feel like, so they feel welcoming to people coming in. I think we've talked before about gender decoding, and I was wondering if you could tell us about that at all today, Alice, because it really wasn't something I'd never heard of before, the idea of our language being gendered even in a subtle way on things like job descriptions.
Yeah, so this was something I'd come across when I was working as a head of school. We did quite a lot of recruitment and we were trying to think about in engineering, you know, how can we improve the diversity of the people that we recruit? And it's not, you know, it's complicated, you know, it's not, there's not an obvious kind of answer to it. And there are a number of different stages. So we were kind of looking at all the bits and bobs of the process. And one of the things that we came across was this sort of gender-coded language, which I'd not come across before, which is where if you have a job advert, you might naturally word it in such a way that without thinking about it, you're putting off certain groups from applying, maybe women, non-binary people from applying because of the particular kind of words that you're using in that language in that advert. And there are very simple tools online where you can just put that, copy and paste that text through into a gender decoder, and it will kind of pick out some of the words. And it might be to sort of words that often play on the individual are typically what they would say are kind of male coded or masculine coded. And ones that are more collaborative and sort of consensus building and so on. And I know that there's kind of stereotypes in that like, you know, we might want to debate as well. But there are certain words that will certainly put off a number of women applying. And so, and apparently if you change the language such that it's either neutral or it's what they call sort of female coded or feminine coded, then it doesn't put off men applying, but it does more to help bring in more women applying, or my, you know, people from non-binary communities as well, but applying for those jobs, because it's just not seen like a kind of like people like to see themselves in a job, and if the language around the job sounds like someone that doesn't fit with what you see as yourself, then you can see why you might think, oh well, you know, it's not for me for one reason or another. So that was just one thing that we started to do, was to try to kind of just very subtle changes to, I mean, it literally would be like three or four words in an advert, but suddenly you're like, oh, that sounds more like something I'd like to do, you know. And so you can kind of see how it
does make
works.
A difference.
Yeah, and it is sometimes subtle things. It's like in you know, various meetings I've been over the years where we do like an anonymous process of some sort. I mean, this could be for an interview, it could be in an exam board or something like that, where you have people identified by numbers. And often the discussion will be make an assumption that everyone is a he. So, you know, oh, he'll be doing this or he'll be doing that. When he turns up for the interview, and I would sort of say, well, hang on, do we know from all of these names that these are all men that are coming to this interview? Or, you know, I'm sure that our cohort of students is not, you know, just what, you know, one gender. I mean, it can't possibly be. So, like, you know, this kind of assumption, and you immediately feel like you don't belong when those assumptions are made. And I don't think they're that obvious. Unless you're the person that's not identified by
Absolutely.
That language. And I think that's when you feel like, I don't belong here. This isn't a job for me. This isn't an environment that I am welcome in. And people don't realise it just chips away at your confidence. You just chips away. And you just, in the end, you just think, I'm not going to even sign up for that because I'm not that welcome. And that's such a shame if we're doing that, because we're shooting ourselves in the foot, because diversity, you know, it's such an important thing for creativity and ideas and problem solving, and yet we're actively, you know, narrowing down the field without realizing it. So yeah,
that's what's so important about having people in the room with different experiences, because like you say, you probably wouldn't notice it if I was in if I was a man and I was in that space and we were talking about he using gendered language and everybody else was a man, you're not going to notice it as readily, because you just like, well, that's who's here, you know, that's me.
Yeah.
So it does sometimes take somebody who has that experience to just flag this stuff and point it out. There's something really important about that as well, in that you're feeling like you have a role to play in making sure that that space is open to and welcome for people like yourself to kind of follow in your footsteps through. I think university is very good for that, in terms of matching people together and bolstering confidence and things. But I love that that's work that you're really aware of, because, yeah.
Yeah, I think you become conscious. I think the more experience I've had, the older I'm getting, like, because you never think of yourself as getting older, right? You just think of yourself as just yourself, and yet I know now that I have, you know, had certain experiences, felt uncomfortable myself, and wanted somebody else to be maybe in the room saying, making me feel like I'm more welcome. And I think I become, the older I'm getting, the more I'm conscious that I ought to be the one that's saying something, because it's not always easy. Like sometimes I would have been the person sitting there thinking, I really want to say something, but I don't want to accept, you know, upset X, Y, and Z in the room. So I'm not going to say anything. And it's like, you know, I get a bit past that now. I'm like, right, you know, hang on a minute. Let's make this a bit more inclusive. Let's, you know, just make people feel welcome. And it doesn't take that much. And actually, I mean, again, it's not just people like me that have to speak out, you know, in the particular role that I had. Lots of colleagues, you know, not just women colleagues, you know, lots of colleagues, you know, understand that that's important, and also kind of will also do. So one of the things I used to kind of pipe up with or they or she, you know, like when everyone's just saying he. And now I find that, you know, other colleagues, you know, other male colleagues are actually doing that on my behalf or on our behalf, if you like. And I just think, hooray, you know, it doesn't have to be the people in the minority that are pointing this out. That's the, you know, the end point that you want to get to. It's just like, let's just make this inclusive and make everybody feel included. And
things aren't perfect now. It's not a job done. Tick that box. But it does feel like science and engineering, at least what we can talk about here today in the kind of STEM bracket, I guess, that does feel like it's changing a bit for the better.
I hope so.
Scary prospect to you.
Honestly, just comparing people from, like, friends I know from other branches in engineering, on my course, we have a lot more girls than, say, electrical or mechanical. So that in itself is, like, at least in material science, I don't know what it is that attracts more girls, but there is something. And it's really nice to have that. And as Alice said, it's really important to have someone older than you, or someone on a different level who's making stuff inclusive for you. And it does make a big difference when you use language like, you know, or she.
Talking about material science, both of you are really passionate about kind of making a positive impact on the world. Did you start with that when you went into your kind of respective disciplines? And Alice, I don't even know where to start on what your discipline is. You're so interdisciplinary. did you start with the passion, or did you kind of start with, I'm really good at these subjects, what can I do with that? And then kind of go through it in a more like methodical, academic subject-based way.
Well, I mean, I always used to describe myself as having a bit of a greedy personality, so I liked pretty much all subjects. I just happened to, you have to narrow it down in a UK system where you have to kind of go and pick A levels. So like I didn't really want to just narrow it down to kind of sort of STEM type subjects. Actually, I would have been very happy doing like languages. I really enjoyed. I enjoyed.
You're
geography.
Both like that, actually.
I know, that's like you've stolen the words from my mouth.
So it's like, I think it was quite hard, you know. Like, so you get channeled to a degree, and then I was still really interested in the kind of the astronomy side of it and things like that. But when I actually started thinking about, you know, work, like the world of work and jobs and things, I guess I kind of felt like, well, I could sit on top of a mountain and stare at stars through a telescope, and that would be lovely. But it doesn't feel like, I know, like there's important stuff you have to do in fundamental science, but I just felt, for me, I'm a bit more like, I need to see this kind of like a bit more of an immediate return.
Like a tangible thing.
Yeah. Something that you can kind of get stuck into and actually see the difference. And so I started to try and shift I consciously tried to shift into the kind of more environmental side. I've always really enjoyed being outdoors and the, you know, just being out in the environment more generally. And so I was just trying to kind of shift it in that direction. So I ended up, the first step was to take it into climate science and atmospheric science. So I'd kind of like, I still had a bit of the astronomy stuff and took it into the environmental stuff. And then I actually then left academia after that because I thought, this isn't for me. This is all too narrow and nothing ever changes. And then a job came up at the Tyndall Centre at the University of Manchester, which was advertised as they wanted a physical scientist who could communicate. And I'd been working a bit in communications because I thought I wanted to do like museum work and stuff like that.
Do you want to quickly explain what the Tyndall Centre is?
Yeah, so the Tyndall Centre is an interdisciplinary research centre across a number of different universities, but Manchester's always had a really big part of it. It was part of the initial kind of proposal to build this centre. And it's interdisciplinary in the sense that as in across all disciplines, not just sort of interdisciplinary within science and engineering. So, you know, there are social scientists, there are economists, historians, philosophers, you know, engineers, physicists, et cetera, et cetera. And like the idea is that we all focus on climate change one way or another and try to kind of think about the research questions across the disciplines before you even start the project, rather than just bringing the disciplines in to try to solve a project, if that makes sense.
Yeah, when you've already established what the project is.
Yeah, yeah. So you kind of think about those questions together. And it always had a policy relevant remit. So in other words, most research organisations that were set up at that time, which was around the year 2000, purely focused on academic research and sometimes industrial impact. We were explicitly told to engage with policy and to try to influence policy and to try to write our work in such a way that was like more accessible, which is why when the job came up, they wanted these communication skills as well as the kind of physical sciences stuff, because the communication stuff and side of it was really important. So writing for an academic journal being really different to writing for, you know, a briefing note for an MP and that kind of thing. And we needed to kind of get trained in that. So, you know, and so that's why where you get that sort of more immediate feedback, because literally within the first 12 months of me being within the Tyndall Centre, I found myself in front of a select committee in the parliament, you know, sort of parliamentary select committee.
Deep
someone
end.
Taking all the kind of every word down that I was saying and asking me questions and so on about climate change. And I was like, wow, this is really exciting. I actually feel like I'm doing something useful. So, yeah. And I've never looked back.
Yeah, you have that benefit of looking at so things at a much broader level, wider scope.
Yeah.
I think my story is very, very similar to Alice's. At school, again, I was always inclined towards like literature, history. I studied psychology. I liked that as well. And then I, of course, liked the sciences. So for me, it took me like almost 2 or 3 years to even decide that I wanted to go into engineering, because it was so hard to narrow it down and just like leave the others. But then
you're both very curious people, basically.
I guess. And so when I did decide on engineering, the reason I took materials is because by nature it's so interdisciplinary. There's like the requirements for the course was like maths, physics, chemistry, any two from the three. So I knew that in some way or the other all three would be combined on the course. Now I even have like I think there's a unit on biology. So there's pretty much anything. And I always knew I could keep like my literature hobbies and the artsy stuff on the side, going on the side, I mean. But so I started off choosing it only because it gave me a lot of flexibility with where I could go. But it's only when I came here and I started studying it when I realized that if I do want to look at a career in material science or engineering, sustainability is like the number one problem for the future, at least. And for me, my grandfather has a farm back home. So I spent most of my summers on farms. So I was very connected with nature as well. And then I could see as I grew up, the seasons changing, and we had like rain in summer and some odd months. So it's something you can see that's happening and that's changing over time. So I realized.
You were aware of that kind of thing as a child.
Yeah,
well.
So I knew there was a problem, and then I did want to contribute in some way. And I felt like this was a really good opportunity, because there's pretty much anything you can go into with materials, into like automobile, energy, biomaterials, anything. Right now, I'm really interested in sustainable fashion, because I know my friends and people my age shop from a lot of fast fashion stores. And then I think fashion's the second most polluting industry, if I'm not wrong. But so, I mean, there's something, there's a lot of need. There's a need in the industry. And if I can sort of fill a gap in any way in the future, that sounds really good. And it's really fulfilling as well. So, yeah.
Do you think you're still on that journey then of discovering, you've kind of chosen your discipline, I guess, for now in terms of what you're studying, but you're still on the journey?
Yeah, I'm still narrowing it. Because I'm in like first year, so and this, because there's so many things to do, it kind of gets overwhelming at times. Because you're like, and I feel like what you said about policy is also so important, because no amount of scientific innovation will make any change unless it's implemented in policies and by governments and things. So again, like the tangible impact is really important as well. So it's kind of confusing, if I'm being honest, to like figure out what you want to do. But I feel like I've sort of narrowed down a path at least, and then we'll figure it out as it goes.
Yeah, it's kind of okay that it's confusing, because you're in the discovery phase now. You're at uni and you're getting to see all of these different kind of pathways stack up, some that you probably didn't even know existed before.
That's true. And I feel uni is such a good place to being exposed to so many different things. Because remember I said the book that got me into materials was by Professor Mark Miodownik. Not sure if the pronunciation is right. But he actually came to the university 2 weeks ago for a conference. And I went and saw, and I met him, and I showed him his book, and I was like, this is what got me to do this. And he signed the book for me. That's such a full circle moment. And then it was also about sustainability, the whole lecture. And then when I heard him talk about it, I was like, you know, I feel like I am on the right path, and this is what I want to do. So I feel like it's a really good place to just explore different options and get to know what people are doing, be inspired. Yeah.
Is that something which you both relate to, that like ongoing discovery? Does that continue into your career? Has that been a case of you're like, yep, this is what I want to do now, and then you've done it and thought, I could add to that by doing this?
Yeah, it does continue. I mean, I think one of the wonderful things about academic research and working as an academic, you know, I feel very privileged to be working as an academic, because particularly in our area as well, the research, the field changes really quickly. So, and this was something that I guess I actively chose to move away from, an area that moved much more slowly, to something that kind of would shift and change with the policy stuff, because, you know, like politics and geopolitics and so on shift and change the environment that you're working in when you're working in climate change. So that kind of keeps it always feeling like you're doing something new. But at the same time, I suppose there were other things, you know, like one of the, I've always had a bit of a bee in my bonnet about
what you can say.
Women in physics and engineering and so on. And so I kind of, that was something that I had written about when I was working as academic researcher. But I suppose when I had an opportunity to take on like a leadership role within the university, it you know, I remember saying in my interview, it was one of the things that I really expressly wanted to tackle. And address and think about more. And so that became quite a new challenge. So even though the environmental and the climate change agenda was also really important to me at that time, and then COVID came along as well. So, I mean, like the whole thing was kind of thrown up a little bit in the air. But it was actually more the inclusivity side of things. And that whole agenda was shifting as well at the same time.
Yeah.
But it was really, that was something that I was really passionate about and very felt very privileged that as an academic, I could move into doing something that was more targeted around some of those sorts of things and actually do some of the things that had, you know, try to address some of the things that had kind of bugged me for a long time. But yeah, I mean, I being still a greedy personality, that doesn't disappear. So like, I was like, okay, well, I've done a bit of that. And you know, some things change and like, you know, you make some difference in some ways, but I want, there are new kind of questions coming up in the research side that I want to address. There are some really interesting stuff around. One of the areas I work on is looking at the international shipping sector, which is a sector that nobody generally thinks about, but
just an FYI for anyone listening, when I last met up with both Alice and Ishita, they started talking about shipping out of nowhere, having never met each other before, for about 5 minutes, and I was completely confused.
Well, honestly,
but it was interesting. I just couldn't believe that you were both so passionate about this area.
No, because I wrote about it in my statement of purpose, and I was like fascinated that that was what you had a project on or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look around us now, and you know, pretty much everything that's in our room, one way or another, has probably come to us on, particularly in an island nation like the UK. Come on, a ship. But you know, there are like all sectors, there are emissions associated with stuff that we do around, you know, shipping and climate change. So yeah, so that's become a newish area of interest for me, and yeah, new things are coming up all the time. So you shift and change to the kind of how the research agenda is changing to a degree if you work in academia, and I guess that's what I'm still doing. So yeah, still looking for the next thing.
Sounds really inspiring, but also comforting that you're not deciding your whole future at such a young age, because sometimes it can feel that way when you choose your, like you said before, Alice, A-levels and those qualifications just pre-uni, you're actually so young then. When you're choosing those and then your degree, sometimes people think of that like, this is going to be my occupation forever, but that is really not what it needs to be, especially not in engineering and science. So for anyone who's on that journey, that must be quite a comfort that you can always continue exploring the ways that you want to go.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many amazing opportunities and you can make some, you know, make opportunities, but also you know opportunities sometimes come along which you don't even realize are going to come along. And I do often tell people, whether it's an academic advisee or someone I'm supervising, you know, don't worry too much about not really knowing what it is that is going to be the what you do, because you probably change your mind anyway in 5 years' time. So, you know, and I think that has shifted a lot in the last 20 years, you know, it's like the whole mindset around actually people don't necessarily feel they have to pick something and then that's the job for life. I think, you know, the world is shifted a lot. There's a lot of different ways of which you can kind of, you know, run your life, if you like. And so, yeah, not being stressed about the idea that you don't know, because, like, who knows? I mean, like, the world changes around you, so you can't necessarily know where the opportunities are going to be.
So true. There's that statistic about by 20, 30 or 50, how many jobs will exist that no one has now. It's always changing. But it's funny you said that about in 5 years, who knows what you'll want to do, because that leads me on to the final question that I wanted to ask you both today. And it was about the last 5 years. Essentially, if you could tell yourself one thing 5 years ago that would have better prepared you for life since then, what would that thing be? And that can be a really tiny thing. It doesn't have to be a big, momentous piece of advice.
It's so funny we were just talking about this, because this is exactly what I was going to say for my... I think I took so much pressure in school about picking something and then having to stick to it. And even though both my parents were engineers and neither of them are doing engineering now, I did sort of have the reassurance that things can change. But I think I was really, really stressed about picking something and narrowing it down and, you know, not having other options. But I would definitely tell myself to not put so much pressure on myself about what's going to happen. I think after COVID, I've always been a good student mostly, but then after COVID, there was like a dip in my grades, and I genuinely thought it was the end of the world and I wouldn't get into a good university and stuff. But I think I'm so happy now, and I feel like everything just happens for the best, and you are where you're meant to be. So I feel like I would just tell myself to let things happen. And I mean, if you have a drive and you want to do something and you have some sort of like for me, it's sustainability. If you have some sort of path in your mind, I think it just turns out the way it should. So yeah,
I think for me, it's about. I mean, it's something I used to think about anyway, but like I think it's much more kind of clear to me now, is that you can only change so much as an individual, and actually the power is in teams and communities and groups of people doing stuff. And if something doesn't work out, and if you don't get to where you think you wanted to get to, don't beat yourself up about it, because there's so many complex factors in the world as to why things do or don't happen in the way you might really ideally want to intend to, you know, it to be an outcome. And so, you know, lots of the battles, whether you're working in climate change, sustainability more broadly, whether it's about inclusivity, you know, these things are not going to suddenly be resolved just because you're really enthusiastic and trying to do stuff, you know. But you know, it's easy to get disillusioned and find it, you know, disheartening when you don't make as many steps forward as you'd hoped. And sometimes you make steps back and you feel, you know, why did that go wrong? But it isn't about individuals. It's about the collective, and it's about, you know, generally moving forward. And sometimes you'll get knockbacks, but the fact that you were part of it in any case is still, it's not regrettable. You've still done something useful, even if you can't quite see it at the time. So yeah, don't give up, and don't ever, you know, beat yourself up about things that don't quite work out, is the thing that I'm telling myself now. It's like, just keep going, be fine.
I love both of those points. And it's really important that putting pressure on yourself and how much responsibility one person can hold. It's the same whether you're trying to choose the perfect career for the rest of your life as a teenager, or also if you're trying to kind of change whole systems which have been in place for generations. Not one person can do that. So I think we can feel this weight on our backs to kind of change everything overnight. And it's better problem if it's shared. And we can all work on it together and not be one person.
Yeah, and empowering.
Feeling
empowering
that pressure.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's like, it's not, yeah. If you can help other people to feel energized, and, you know, then collectively you're going to be stronger.
That's amazing. That concludes our chat today. Thank you so much for joining me. and see you next time.